Yesterday, I reminded you of the rationale of how one gets to Fock space. So that's a representation theory, the structure of the representation space for all relativistic perturbative quantum field theories. And that's, of course, a space that allows for particle annihilation and creation. And so this works for gravitons, so perturbative excitations, just as well as it does for our quantum fields. And we'll hear more about this later on today when we discuss exactly covariant quantum field theory for gravity. Now, then I contrasted also by partially by way of revision of what you surely already know, I contrasted two ways of doing quantum mechanics, solving quantum mechanics. So the first one is doing it the canonical way, where you your starting point, your classical starting point are phase space variables, you know, like x's and p's and some Hamiltonian. And then you look for representations of these in terms of self-adjoint operators. And then, well, essentially you try to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, that is, find its eigen spectrum and eigenstates. Now, there's an alternative way of doing that, which is not based on the Hamiltonian, but is based on the Lagrangian or the associated action integral, right? And so that's the alternative way of doing that. Well, as I briefly sketched and reminded you, then you can, for instance, for simple cases like non-relativistic particles, you can actually compute something that's called the propagator, and the content, I mean, the dynamical content of that is equivalent to what you have as a Hamiltonian, but it gives you a slightly different looking way of doing things. And of course, this continues to be true. There's two ways of quantizing things, roughly speaking, when you go to a relativistic quantum field series. Now, that's a bit. And I think it's most helpful to think about these two ways as equivalent ways of trying to solve the theory, as it is really also the case in quantum mechanics. In practice, these two different approaches look often sufficiently different that you can regard them as complementary. So things that look straightforward in one don't in the other, and vice versa. Now, maybe the most prominent differences between kind of the path integral, or interchangeably, I use the word covariant quantization, is that Lorentz invariance is manifest, as one says. Now, of course, we're talking, when I say relativistic quantum field theory, implicitly, I'm assuming I'm looking at quantum fields that live on flat Minkowski space. So I have certainly the Poincaré group acting. Now, what is meant by manifest, it means more or less, well, it's obvious that things are Lorentz invariant. Just if you write them down at the level of the action, right, the only thing you have to check that, well, the fields and quantities that appear have the right tensor structure. And then you just have to make sure that all the indices are contracted. And then you get a Lorentz invariant object. So in that sense, Lorentz invariance is manifest. And that's very helpful in many cases. So it's very helpful as a starting point for developing Feynman style diagrammatics, so a systematic perturbative expansion of the quantum field theory. And it's also, that aspect is also particularly important when treating gauge field theories. So, and of course, our most important kind of physical quantum field theories are, of course, of this type. Now, by contrast, so what's true for the canonical quantization, there you're breaking explicitly kind of the four-dimensional Lorentz invariance, but as a bonus, kind of unitarity is manifest. So essentially, all that you need to have is a self-adjoint Hamiltonian, and then you can be assured of unitarity. Now, of course, it's still true that if you do everything properly, canonically formulated, the theory is still manifestly Lorentz invariant and covariant, as appropriately as you see immediately in this covariant approach. For example, of course, you can then define how the Poincaré group acts on the quantities of your canonical formulation. It just looks all a little bit more complicated. It's much less obvious, so it's much less manifest. So so that's just to reiterate my comment that, well, for many purposes, these are kind of complementary, but ultimately equivalent. And there's, of course, also a certain, I would say, conservation of difficulty. So if you have some intrinsic difficulties of, you know, quantizing the theory, and of course that's certainly true for the case of gravity, well, then you'll find that certain, you know, difficulties you meet here in some disguise or in some slightly different form you would also meet here. Well, I should say, so of course the case of quantum gravity, if you consider it as going beyond just a perturbative quantization, you still essentially have these two options. And of course, we'll come back to these two themes during the course of my lectures further on. And it's an ongoing debate. I think, again, the most helpful way is to think of them as, hopefully, once the dust has settled, you know, and we have a theory of quantum gravity, of course, you should be able to covariantly formulate it, you should be able to kind of canonically formulate it. But things do look sufficiently different to merit, you know, calling them different approaches. And that's also what we'll be doing. And there is a, well, and also the pendulum swings back and forth over time, what people think of as the appropriate way of quantizing gravity. So when I was a student, a kind of PhD student back, that's a long time ago, at Imperial College in London, we people there were doing canonical quantization, and that was just the right thing to do in those days. And there were, of course, these other chaps in Cambridge that were doing covariant quantization. That was just so ill-defined. Now, of course, you know, there are many sides to these arguments, and they have also been changing over time, as I said. Okay, now, what we want to do to start with, now that's our next step here, we'll focus on doing the gravitational path integral, and I already yesterday started, promised you a discussion of this. So essentially, you can characterize it as an implementation of the superposition principle, which you can apply in principle to arbitrary theories. Now, what it amounts to in gravity is kind of to start with a very formal way of just writing down what this path integral is meant to be in the continuum. So let me do this. Let me write it on the blackboard for you. So a customary notation for the path integral is Z, familiar to you from field theory, I'm sure. Now, I'm fixing, you know, like for the particle, I fixed an initial and a final state. I do the same here for gravity. And that usually takes the form of fixing kind of two, usually spatial boundaries, and fixing an equivalence class of spatial matrix on these boundaries. So that's kind of, think of that as an in state, or that as an out state, and this as an in state. ij. So 3 just means 3-dimensional metric. And then comes your path integral. So it's a formal functional integration over matrix modular diffeomorphisms. I'll say something more about this in a second. And then you're just superposing complex amplitudes. And the complex amplitudes, they know just about the classical weight of the path. Now, what's the path here? What's the analog of the particle path, you know, between x1 and x2? It's here a space-time geometry that kind of interpolates between two spatial geometries. So kind of the time on it. So and the weight of this, let me just use here kind of the Einstein-Hilbert action for this. So this is a picture that one draws with this. So these two circles here, they represent kind of the three geometries. So this is kind of the three geometry, the in state. And this is the out state, final configuration, the prime. And now I look for kind of four-dimensional geometries which correspond to diffeomorphism equivalence classes of metrics that interpolate between these boundary conditions. And kind of the path integral prescription is, well, you should be integrating over all complex amplitudes that are associated with any possible kind of virtual space-time geometry you can stick in between these boundary conditions. OK, so that's what this formal path integral means. So here, the Einstein-Hilbert action is 1 divided by 16 pi gn d4x square root of the modulus of the determinant of the metric g r minus 2 lambda. And for completeness, I'm including here boundary terms. Let me put this down here. Plus 8 p pi gn, the boundary is delta m. In this case, as I've drawn it here, it would be the initial and final kind of spatial surface, d3x. And you're looking then at the induced metric little h on that these spatial boundaries. And this is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And I believe that has already, this expression has already appeared in some of your previous courses. Now, later on in my discussions, well, I will just drop this term in the discussion, of course, for it needs to be there in principle. First of all, to make the variational principle well defined, but also later in the quantum theory, in order for kind of your propagator to have the correct properties under kind of the correct composition properties. So, you know, taking the propagator moving along some time delta t1 and composing that with, you know, another propagator over some time delta t2, that must be equal. If I stick these two things together, there's a consistency condition that it must be equal then to the propagator for the total time interval. Okay, so this is the action. Now, some ingredients I mentioned what are. So this is standard notation for a gauge equivalence class of metrics. So this is one of these gauge orbits, right? I talked about the other day. So this is a diffeomorphism equivalence class of metrics. Now, and this space curly G, G stands for geometry. Now, so this curly space G of M, by definition, is a space of Lorentzian matrix divided by the four-dimensional, the group of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms of space and time. So that's kind of the true configuration space you want to do the integration over. So this is an element of this G of M. Now, of course, it is a highly formal way of writing things down. I mean, the best way to think of that is a statement of intent, that this is something you want to make sense of kind of computationally. And of course, you're guided very much by what you do, say, even by the simple system I presented yesterday, just for the non-relativistic particle. Now, why is this a highly ill-defined object as it stands? So there are a bunch of questions you can ask. So first of all, because this is a functional integral. It's not a simple integral. So what is the measure here? What is that supposed to be? Of course, it should be diffeomorphism invariant, but what should we choose there? And how, well, if one wants really now to do computations, one needs to kind of parameterize this quotient space. And even classically, now this is a highly complicated object. So it's a priori not clear how to parameterize this quotient space at all. So, and how to perform the quotient. How to parameterize it. And then, of course, well, this is a field theoretic, as I said, a functional integration. So without doing anything, this will just be vastly divergent. Essentially, whatever kind of choice of configurations you're putting in here. So. And this is even more divergent than most, of course, as you know. So certainly what one will need to do, if one wants to make any sense of this, is to regularize and subsequently try to renormalize, as one does in quantum field theory, to try and kind of systematically get rid of the affinities that appear when one computes this kind of naively. So you must regularize. But then, of course, again, this becomes tricky, or certainly much more tricky than usual, because I have now a gauge group actually, so a gauge invariance. So I have to make sure that my regularization doesn't mess up with the action of the gauge group. And that's, again, not at all trivial. So the so regularization should preferably be compatible with the gauge invariance. And of course, already for the particle case, if you should have any dreams of going beyond interpretive quantization, then you really have to worry again about the oscillatory character, the complex character of this integral. Now, certainly in simple quantum mechanics, you can do this weak rotation, and that's fairly well-defined procedure, and it continues to be a fairly well-defined procedure for standard relativistic quantum field theories on a fixed background. But in general, well, you don't really know how to ubiquitate. You don't really know how to convert that into, say, a real quantity, real regularized quantity, whose convergence properties you could then discuss in a well-defined manner, and whose behavior under removal, say, of regulators you've introduced, you could rigorously discuss. So that's, again, a big open question in general. So what to do about the factor I? So is there something like a ubiquitation? And actually, it turns out if you just, well, kind of make some shortcuts and kind of simply solve instead of this problem, if you find that too hard to solve, solve an alternative problem where you now don't look at the quotient of Lorentzian matrix module diffeomorphism, but say you start with Euclidean matrix, that's something you could just try and do, then naturally you get here kind of real Boltzmann weights. But then another problem rears its head, namely that this action, that's actually already true for the Lorentzian signature, is unbounded below. So there is, and certainly, well, you might be able to live with that in the Lorentzian formulation, but once you've rotated to Euclidean formulation, well, it just means there are modes here that let this grow without bound. That's the so-called conformal divergence of the path integral. So that's another problem you might have to deal with later on, even if you have found such a ubiquitation. So now the attempt to set up a path integral quantization is really to try kind of address all of these problems and somehow solve them in a way, or put phrase the problem in a way that it's reasonably well defined. And so if you introduce some regulators, which hopefully are sufficiently nice, then ask, does there a theory exists? So one is really giving kind of a constructive, one looks for kind of constructive proofs to make sense of what this whole object should be. And this should include then a prescription of how you get to a reasonable measure and what the support of that measure is going to be. These are actually things that, to start with, you don't really know. So you're writing down kind of these classical looking expressions, but of course you already know, say from standard quantum field theory, that, or even from the particle case I talked about today, that kind of the carrier space eventually in some continuum limit, right, of such a measure will be nothing like nice and smooth classical configurations. Right? So I mentioned to you at the end of yesterday's lecture, for the particle case, you get these Nova differentiable paths. Well, certainly for standard quantum field theory, there are analogous statements you can make. So surely for quantum gravity, well, even worse things are very likely to happen. So that's already kind of anticipating where we'll be going. OK. Now, what I, however, will do first, I will discuss kind of the standard way of trying to make sense of this, namely perturbatively. Yeah, question. Well, it's just the induced metric on one of these boundaries. There is nothing fishy going on yet at this stage, I think. Yes.
So this is an indectum, I guess.
Yeah, this is to start with. It's just pure practice.
So if you want to put in interaction with like other quantum fields, you have to have multiple path integral measures. You also have to integrate over the like.
That is one way of coupling matter to it. Exactly. So they would say if I couple the scalar field to this, then you would say, aha, I have to do a double functional integral. So for each of these geometries, I set up a full quantum field path integral for the matter degrees of freedom. So I have kind of a double integral. So that's the most natural way of doing the coupling. Of course, and to do anything like this beyond perturbation theory, well, that's of course a tricky thing. Okay, but we'll first have a brief look at the perturbation theory and just see what happens there, because of course some of the difficulties of the general case are already present there. Now, let me go here. Okay, so let us have a look at the perturbative path integral first. Now, what's the standard way of doing perturbative point of view theory? Could you give me your favorite classical theory in the form of an action of some, you know, involving kind of the fields, degrees of freedom is settled on. And I split that up into a free part, which is just quadratic in these fields, plus an interaction part, which contains, well, is higher powers, contains higher powers of the field, so of order 3 and higher. And then I have a nice formalism for relativistic field theories, like that of setting up Feynman rules, kind of computing amplitudes, order by order in perturbation theory. Okay, there are of course various caveats in applying this to gravity. Of course, the other day we talked about the issue of the reality of gravitons, and of course gravitons are really what underlies kind of this type of construction. So of course what I would be discussing here very naturally are like graviton scattering processes. But of course the reality of those, I mean the physicality of those, is maybe somewhat questionable. Okay, now, nevertheless, I have here a functioning formalism. Unfortunately, of course, we already know that this perturbative quantization doesn't really lead to a nice, it doesn't converge to a nice theory which would be fundamental for quantum gravity, that is, be valid on all scales. And that, of course, has to do with the perturbative non-renormalizability of the theory, which I've already mentioned and will be getting back to briefly later. Now, what I'll be doing is here, for simplicity, in what I do, I mean, in discussing perturbative quantum field theory, I'll be throwing out this lambda term, because, of course, already classically, Minkowski space is not actually a solution to the classical Einstein equations if I have a lambda term here. And my justification for dropping this for the time being is, of course, that we already know that if it's there, it's presumably very, very, very small. So it doesn't play really a role in the computational scattering amplitudes. So that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. So the action you'll be looking at. consisting just of the curvature scalar or Ricci scalar. And of course, what we want to do, we want to expand this in powers of F mu. These were defined to be these fields in the linearized approximation. So schematically, there's something one can kind of say immediately on knowing what the structure of this R is. This, of course, came from a contraction of the Riemann tensor. And the Riemann tensor contains up to second order in derivatives of the metric, and therefore also of F mu nu. Okay, so it's clear that schematically, if I now do my expansion, my F expansion, I can write this R as to lowest order terms of the form del F, where I'm allowing for partial integrations freely. Right? At the next order, well, I still have two. I have then three Fs and two derivatives. And again, I can always use partial integration to bring it into the form F del F del F. And that continues to be true at higher order. So of course, this will, and then we do something else. Namely, we define now these F fields so as to absorb this overall factor here, right? And how do I do this? I define some F tilde, and that's 1 divided by square root of 16 pi gn times my old f. And then you'll see what will happen here, right? So the quadratic term, so this will just disappear, this prefactor. This will be just absorbed. So what is the first term I get here under the integral will be something like del f tilde, plus, and now here I have one more of the f's, so I'll get one explicit square root appearing here. So 16 pi gn f. So let me group this together with the derivative free part of f, del f tilde, plus, now, the term 16 pi gn f all squared, f tilde, plus higher order. Okay. So there are various things to be said about this. So this is now, of course, this is my the quadratic. So that's a free Lagrangian. And that, of course, coincides exactly with the linearized Lagrangian you worked out in yesterday's problems. Yes? So that's this thing. And of course, all the remainder here is the interacting part of the Lagrangian. And you see, well, structurally, there's nothing very new, apart from the fact that, of course, the index structure is much more complicated than, say, in scalar field theory. But this is like, if I was looking at scalar field theory, that would be a del phi term, so just a standard kind of covariant derivative term, and you see here the same thing here, plus then these higher order interactions. Now, I'll immediately drop these tildes after here. But I have a few more comments on the general structure here. First, so the absorbing of this prefactor GN into the field, I mean, by into a redefinition of my linearized fields, puts this kind of in a form which is analogous to what you have in electromagnetism. And in particular, kind of it highlights the role of this square root of GN, Newton's constant, as kind of the relevant coupling constant, if you like. Of course, here I'm again, I'm working in natural units. So H bar and C have been set to 1. So however, if you just to see what this is, so the square root of Gn in these units is essentially 1 over m Planck. And of course, that's a very big quantity. So that's, in fact, a very small coupling parameter. And kind of this way of writing things makes it kind of obvious that it plays this role. So this is my effectively the coupling constant, which will, of course, appear when I now start writing down kind of Feynman rules for the theory. Right? This will be a weight that will appear kind of in the vertex Feynman rules, which incorporates the interactions of gravitons with gravitons. Now, another thing to note is that even if I just start from this simple Lagrangian here, because it's not polynomial in the Fs. Why? Because it contains the inverse metric. In addition, here, of course, I have this determinantal factor, which likewise is not polynomial in G mu and therefore also not in F mu. This is an infinite series. So if I do this expansion, I genuinely get an infinite series. And that if you would do Young-Mills theory, that's actually not the case. So if you start from the kind of F mu action, it breaks off after fourth order. But here, you see, well, you can already see it will be a hell of a job to work out the Feynman rules for all these kind of vertex contributions that will pop up at these higher orders. Yeah. So things become really vastly more complicated. You had a question?
Yes. How can you say that square root GN is a small coupling cost you for expanding about, since it's a dimensionful parameter?
Well, of course, you always compare it to something. But of course, you have some couplings are dimension-full and some couplings.
Right, but I mean, just with the argument that it's small, so that
series. Well, of course, you have to relate the strength of the coupling to whatever physical processes you're considering. So, in that context, I think it's a perfectly valid way of phrasing it this way. And really, of course, we have already seen some of these kind of hand-waving semi-classical arguments that, you know, nailing down kind of quantum gravity effects will be very difficult just because of the smallness, say, of the length scale involved. Or here, it reappears as a smallness of this effective coupling. So it's not just a fake my way of writing it like this, but it's that's a generally true effect. OK, now, so two things. If one now really wants to set up the perturbation theory, there are certainly two things one will want to do. So the first one is to work out the propagator of the theory, right? And then to work out the vertices of the theory. And of course, we won't be indulging in this latter part because that's a major exercise. And I don't think it teaches you terribly a lot, apart from the fact that perturbative quantum gravity is a very, very complicated affair. Now, so let us look at the graviton propagator in perturbative gravity. And I was happy to learn that you already have had a similar discussion for the case of QED in your QFT2 course. So I can freely refer to things learned from there. So of course, the most helpful comparison to understand what's going on in gravity is to look at QED, because also QED also has, of course, a gauge invariance, which is not too dissimilar structurally from what we have here. So what did we have in QED? Work with an action. I'm just focusing on the pure photon part of the action. So that's exactly our standard term, F mu nu, F mu nu. And well, what you do in order to understand what the propagator of the theory is, of course, for electromagnetism, this is actually just quadratic in A. Right. So, but the way to write it is kind of throwing out all kind of boundary terms you might pick up from partial integrations, and ending up with writing the integrand as A mu. So that's, of course, your fundamental field, your gauge potential for electromagnetism, for the photon, times some matrix M mu nu, A nu. So you write it in this form. And this, of course, is not just a matrix. Of course, it has two matrix indices. But it's, of course, a differential operator, a second order differential operator. OK, and then you get to the propagator of the theory by simply inverting this operator. And there, of course, you meet perhaps somewhat of a surprise that this turns out not to be invertible as an operator. So what does it mean? Well, it has zero modes. And of course, their origin is precisely the invariance of this object under U1 gauge transformations. Okay. And there are various ways of fixing it. The way you fixed it in the lectures was just to add to the action explicit and explicit gauge fixing term, which modified this M in such a way that it then was invertible. Okay. Now, of course, we already know the action we have to look at. In gravity, the relevant action, it's exactly this Fields-Pauli action that you were working out yesterday. So for gravity, Lagrangian FP, just to be completely explicit about it, let me just write it down. So plenty of indices, of course, now. So it's a del lambda F mu nu squared, essentially, this term, minus 1/2. And these are already kind of my F tilde. So I've dropped the tilde and absorbed this factor. D lambda F mu mu D del lambda F mu nu minus del lambda F mu nu del mu F lambda nu plus del lambda F lambda mu del mu F nu nu. So this thing, you want to rewrite, again, you know, throwing away possible terms you pick up in partial integrations. You want to write in the form F rho sigma, some differential operator slash matrix, M rho sigma mu nu F mu mu. So you see that's, of course, exactly imitating this kind of construction. But now your relevant fields, here there were these gauge potentials with one lower Lorentz index. And now you're working on a space of symmetric two tensors. So of course, the tensorial structure, you know, is one level up. Now, of course, you won't be terribly surprised when I tell you that this M, unfortunately, is not invertible, of course, to be anticipated because of the presence of gauge symmetry, namely the diffeomorphisms in this case. So M is not invertible. Now, let me write down a claim of how you can fix this problem. And I'm still contemplating whether this is going to be a homework or not. Namely, adding, really imitating what you did in QED, adding a gauge fixing term, now which now is of the form F mu F mu to the Fields-Pauli Lagrangian, where I've introduced this curly F before, and it's just the expression that appeared in the harmonic gauge condition. F mu of F, little f, is del nu F mu nu minus 1/2 del nu F nu nu. And of course, it's not an accident that precisely this form appears here. So then kind of the differential operator, this four index object, becomes, now let me call it M twiddle to distinguish it from the M I introduced over there, rho sigma mu nu. So a small computation reveals the following structure: eta rho mu eta sigma nu plus 1/2 eta rho sigma eta mu mu del squared. So the dependence of the derivatives simplifies very much. So it's just the derivative squared here. So the box operator, if you like. And this turns out to be invertible. So this, in a way, looks completely analogous to the story in QED. Let me just make one more remark before ending. It turns out that you actually just kind of sticking in a gauge fixing term is a bit too cavalier for the case of gravity. And you have to do something more because if you only stick in such a gauge fixing condition and then kind of start working out your kind of Feynman perturbation theory, it turns out that the theory is actually non-unitary. And that was something not initially realized when people did look at perturbative quantum gravity like as a kind of analog of QED. So So the real good way of doing it, which of course, well, you might already have seen in the case of gauge field theory, is the so-called Fadeev-Popov method. And just to sketch how this goes, one inserts 1 into the path integral. Now, that seems fairly innocent. However, 1 is rewritten in a not entirely straightforward and obvious manner. So that's the 1. Let me just write down this formal expression. I'll discuss it more next time. So this curly f refers to the gauge fixing conditions. Is a functional of f here, and this is now an integration over the gauge group. And what appears here is just a product of delta functions associated with all the gauge conditions you are imposing. So for us, this would be this f mu. And this beautiful object is called the Fadeev-Popov determinant. So somewhat unfortunately, these are the same initials as Fields and Pauli. But this is, yeah, not to be mixed up, I think. So that's the Fadeev-Popov determinant. And what it really is, it's of course a functional determinant that knows about the gauge condition. But geometrically speaking, it's just a Jacobian that appears when you transform from your initial configuration variable, say f mu nu, into variables. You split them up into variables that obey the gauge condition and the rest. And kind of going to these new variables, you pick up a Jacobian, and essentially this is the determinant. And that you need something like, so this is the kind of the crucial part, which we are not allowed to omit if you want to preserve unitarity. And it was realized in 1964 by Feynman that there is a problem, that something is missing. And the person essentially first sorted it out, also in 1964, was Rice DeWitt. And already he understood basically that kind of these additional terms that appear, you can write as an addition to the local Lagrangian in the path integral by invoking so-called ghost fields. And the ghost fields are fermionic variables. And why do fermionic variables appear? Because I insist on writing a determinant as something that sits up kind of in the exponential. And of course, I know when I do a bosonic integration, I always get 1 over determinant. You know, like I have a standard thing like here. To get just the determinant upstairs, I need to substitute the bosonic by fermionic degrees of freedom. And that is exactly what an inclusion of fictitious fermionic ghost particles we do for you. OK, so that's where matter stands. That is where I finish. I was just wondering whether who of you might be interested in a further exposition of that geometric, or it's partially relevant to what we're doing here. Have you seen it? Are you interested in illuminating this a little more, say with a finite dimensional example of what happens with this gauge fixing? OK, vigorous nodding. Then we'll do that briefly at the beginning of next week. I wish you a very good weekend and many good ideas on quantum gravity.